Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and it's really nice to see you again, Christy.
It's great to see you,
How are you?
I'm doing great. We've got a good show today. Adam, we're going to get to talk with Dr. Woody Kessel, former Assistant Surgeon General of the United States, as well as founder and president of Imaginative Health System Solutions, about just that, the Surgeon General of the United States, past, present, and future.
Yeah, he has served over six different surgeon generals and multiple administrations in Congress. Very incredible insights from someone who has been a behind-the-scenes leader for decades.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with him. But first, we have some good research that matters. We're going to talk about bragging about your vacations, Adam.
Yeah, I'm not going to brag too much about mine recently, but we'll talk about some of them and whether your friends want to hear about it. We're going to talk about when you exercise, is there things that are unhealthy about the gyms?
And osteoporosis and the perception that it's just a women's disease.
And then finally about bicycle accidents, they're increasing or not increasing, but they're, you know, really a big problem, particularly for people who don't wear helmets. We'll be talking about that.
Okay.
Let's talk about our very first one about vacation. You know, Christy, not too long ago, I went on a big bike trip. I biked again on the Israel ride from Jerusalem down to Eilat, over 300 miles. You want to hear about it?
Well, apparently, according to the study, maybe I don't. So this is a study in Psychological Science looking at the difference of telling a story of an extraordinary experience compared with social experiences that are shared but maybe not that extraordinary.
Yeah, one of the co-authors of the study, Dr. Daniel Gilbert, is a really renowned Harvard social psychologist who's written a lot about happiness and kind of what makes people happy. And this is kind of the converse, what makes people a little bit less happy. And it turns out, like, for instance, if you went on the bike ride with me and we were to talk about the bike ride, well, we would be happy together. But if you haven't shared an experience with someone, you don't really want to talk about it so much. So you'd be much more likely to want to talk with me about us going out to lunch or the people you went out to lunch last week. And that seems to be a natural phenomenon, but it has some implications, I think, for how we think about those types of experiences we share and how we share them.
Yeah, it makes you think that when people come over to your house, you probably don't want to, like, pull out the big giant photo slide and show every single photograph from your trip to Africa or Israel, for example, but to talk more about things that you have in common that you've shared together.
You know, and they did this by showing people movies that were, like, really great movies that one group saw and then movies that weren't so great that other people saw. And it turned out when people got together, if they hadn't seen that really great movie, they didn't want to talk about that great movie. They wanted to talk about the badder movie, the worser movie that they had all seen. Now, it doesn't think this really means you don't do things that are really motivating and exciting. I think it's just this awareness that sometimes when people aren't able to share – they want to be, you know, listen to themselves, and all of our lives are important, all of the things that we're doing.
I think that's a great point, Adam. Next, we're going to talk about the air quality in our gyms. So it's mostly cold outside, and more of us are starting to exercise in the gym in the wintertime than going outside and bearing the cold. And this is a study looking at the air quality in gyms, just looking at some interesting questions about whether or not that's a totally healthy environment.
And it was in the journal Building and Environment, and it was actually done in Portugal and in Holland. And they were looking at, you know, when they place these monitors in these gymnasiums, are there certain substances, chemicals that we're exposed to that perhaps are in very unhealthy concentrations, like carbon dioxide? We're all breathing really heavily in our spinning sessions.
And that makes us more tired, maybe.
Well, it may or may not be good. And then we're cleaning off these equipment all the time with things that maybe have formaldehyde in them.
And more dust, airborne dust.
As we're all exercising, particularly perhaps if there's carpet in these gyms rather than tile flooring, for instance.
So they did find higher levels of all three of those things, airborne dust, formaldehyde, and carbon dioxide in this study, which, you know, raises some questions about, is that the healthiest air to be breathing? and potentially can contribute to problems if you already have asthma or allergies. Maybe they act up more when you're in the gym. So it could have some implications for you. I think this isn't necessarily tied with bad outcomes. We know exercise is good for you and good for your heart. So I don't want to scare people and say, oh, don't go into a gym because it's got poor air quality.
No, but I think what I do like about it is I've been in gyms before. Sometimes when you're going to hotels and you're going to the gyms, and they don't smell very good. And you walk in,
there's something wrong.
There's an odor in there. And I think this doesn't pass the odor test, which is if it doesn't seem right, it usually isn't. And this is an opportunity to perhaps really say, you know, that if there's not good filtration, if they're not really cleaning appropriately, and if you are smelling something in there that doesn't seem right, you may be being exposed to something and maybe ask them to do an air quality check.
I think that's a great idea.
What's our next research that matters?
Okay. This is about men versus women and osteoporosis. So this was a study published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, where they looked at the medical records of 344 women and 95 men over the age of 50 who had bone fractures at Beth Israel Medical Center. And what they found was that after a fracture, more than half of the women got screened for osteoporosis, but only 18% of the men were screened.
And even after the treatment for the bone injury, only a minority of the men who really perhaps could be at risk were given calcium and vitamin D to prevent osteoporosis. And, Christy and I just raised this question that we were just talking about, which is, you know, perhaps there's a little hidden bias that, you know, we don't see osteoporosis as frequently as men, so we don't think about it. And the guidelines aren't as clear about what to do about screening, but yet there are subgroups of men who are really at risk and perhaps we should think about a lot more.
So as you're advancing in age, if you have low body mass, you're very thin, if you have a history of having fractures where you didn't have a major trauma or car accident or something, if you've been taking long-term steroid medications like prednisone.
If you drink a fair amount of alcohol and you smoke cigarettes, you're pretty high risk if you're a woman or a man. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to say, hey, men out there, this is something that you probably could at least talk with your doctor about and at least be assessed as to whether or not it's appropriate to do a formal screen.
Yep, it is confusing, but it's worth a conversation with your doctor. Let's talk now about another cause of breaking bones, which is riding your bicycle.
You know, we've had three bicyclists in our local region who've been killed in the last couple months, and it turns out that many of them weren't wearing helmets. And, you know, there are problems with the cars, there's problems with the bicycles and unsafe behavior. But we know there are more people that are biking now, and the roads aren't always really safe. And so this is some research that just looks at the process of bicycling and dying. And the bottom line, Christy, they got to wear a helmet. You can't be drinking while you're biking. And the car is going to have to do a much better job of sharing the road, too.
That is true. That number of bicyclists killed in a motor vehicle crash climbed 16% between 2010 and 2012, in just 2 years. And they were mostly in the setting of not wearing a helmet, and more than a quarter were legally drunk while riding their bike, which doesn't seem like a good idea.
Yeah, Christy, did I just tell you I got back from Israel and I rode 300 miles on a bicycle?
Oh, and you were not
drunk. You don't want to hear about that. But I did wear my helmet and I did not drink and bicycle.
Well, that is good. I'm very proud of you, Adam. You'll have to tell me more about it later.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Woody Kessel about the Surgeon General, past, present, and future. Please stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Woody Kessel, former Assistant Surgeon General and founder as well as president of eMagitive Health System Solutions, about the Surgeon General of the United States, past, present, and future.
Welcome, Dr. Kessel. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Adam and Christy.
You know, you've had just a remarkable medical career, and thinking about, you know, being the former assistant surgeon general and being a senior advisor to the White House, to cabinets, to 8 different administrations over your career. Tell us, where did it start for you, and did you know that this would be the direction of your career?
Actually, no. My career began. I studied electrical engineering, a little bit of bioengineering in Philadelphia, and but I think even then, when I was looking for solutions to health problems, applying engineering principles, I began to see a broader and bigger context. One of the early projects I worked on, for example, was a device that measured the pulse of a premature infant. So the engineering was sort of measuring the pulse, but the context was really beginning to appreciate being born too soon, being born small. Certainly the engineering challenges that posed, but also trying to begin to understand why these children were premature and what the challenges that they faced.
You know, as a pediatrician, did you gravitate towards these and decide that's why you were going to go into pediatrics? How did you get that real interest in children's health?
Well, I think it began, interestingly enough, as an undergraduate, being exposed to some of the challenges of prematurity. And then I decided that I would pursue medicine after completing undergraduate engineering. And I went to medical school at Einstein in the South Bronx. And it was largely in the South Bronx where I began to see abject poverty, the challenges that that community was struggling with, and at the same time, I'm trying to master the science of medicine, and it was in a context of probably one of the most challenging communities in the United States. I moved on to Boston to be a pediatric health officer, resident in primary care, and even in Boston, I was a house officer at Boston City Hospital. And the challenges that the urban inner-city community and the children were facing were just overwhelming. It became evident to me that even mastering the best of pediatric medical science wasn't going to solve the problems that these kids were facing. And when I finished my residency, I decided to come to Washington as the Robert Wood Johnson Fellow and was fortunate enough to work with folks in the Department of Health and Human Services. Then it was called HEW. And I began with Secretary Califano and Surgeon General Julie Richman, trying to look at what were the contexts of these problems, what were the origins, where did they come from, and what were the solutions, if you will. I mean, I started to consider myself a macro pediatrician, if you will, not trying to combine public health and personal health services.
Well, I don't know if we could call you Big Mac, but you certainly have done some incredibly big things.
And so you went straight from residency into starting to try to understand and tackle some of the national level problems beyond just the one-to-one doctoring, but thinking about the systems. Where did you start, and what were some of the first initiatives that you tackled as a young, budding pediatrician?
Well, I was fortunate enough to work right in the Office of the Secretary again, then it was HEW, Health Education and Welfare, moved on to become, when education became a separate cabinet department, became the Department of Health and Human Services. And I worked directly in the Office of the Secretary and with Dr. Julie Richman. Julie was Assistant Secretary for Health and Surgeon General. And Julie challenged me to try to find out what the problems were for children and what might be some of the solutions. The first thing that I looked at was prematurity, infant health, infant mortality, low birth weight. Those were the initial projects that I took on, and I began to learn about using data to solve problems, looking at what the data would really direct us toward with solutions.
So you're now in this in Washington. You're, for our listeners to set this up, you're beginning a career to work with the Surgeon Generals of the United States. Tell us, what is and was the Surgeon General of the United States? I think when we most people think about this, perhaps one figure comes to mind, and I'm sure you'll talk about C. Everett Koop, but the Surgeon General of the United States has been there for over 100 years. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I didn't know much about the Surgeon General and didn't know much about policy making for kids at the, you know, at the federal level. And I became aware of something called the United States Public Health Service that was around since 1798, and it largely came into being as one of the first uniformed services of the United States, dealing with largely challenges in the colony, infectious disease, the first formations of the United States. And interestingly enough, its primary focus in those days was quarantine. Quarantine's an interesting approach because clearly with the current challenges with Ebola, mm-hmm. the whole idea of separating folks who are infected was the principal activity then. We've come a long way since then with antibiotics and much more sophisticated treatments, but it's still interesting that Ebola still challenges us at our roots. But I joined the United States Public Health Service, and it's one of the seven uniformed services in the United States. And the Surgeon General is actually a rank in the United States Public Health Service. We've come to understand that rank and that person and that job more or less as the same. And interestingly enough, I think over time, the Surgeon General of the United States has become, if you will, the nation's doctor. The Surgeon General translates science into credible, understandable information so that we all can make healthier and wiser choices about our health as individuals and as communities.
So do you explain it to people that the Surgeon General is sort of the figurehead for that whole national public health system, sort of the person who's communicating and who is the leader of that, or is it more nebulous than that?
Well, I think you characterized it, you know, quite well. When I had to explain to my mom how is it that I'm now wearing a uniform and mm-hmm. working for the Surgeon General, I explained to her that it was actually I who got up early in the morning and went down to the dock and picked up all the cigarette packages and brought them upstairs, and it was I who stamped each one of those packages about declaring that cigarette smoking was harmful to your health, a warning from the Surgeon General. So she had a better understanding of that. But I think you characterized it quite well. The Surgeon General is a physician, an accomplished physician, in the United States, and comes to the position largely trying to synthesize and understand health challenges, public health challenges, and mostly characterized by disease prevention and health promotion, and provides information and advice largely for the American people. But frankly, our Surgeon General has become a voice for health globally as well.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Woody Kessel, former Assistant Surgeon General, and his incredible work serving and directing policy for many administrations and talking about the Surgeon General of the United States, past, present, and future. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Woody Kessel, former Assistant Surgeon General, as well as founder and president of Imaginative Health System Solutions, about the Surgeon General of the United States, past, present, and future. And before the break, Dr. Kessel, you were sharing with us and helping explain how you have taught your mom and now our listeners about what exactly a Surgeon General is. You've worked with several of them through your career. What stands out as a story to share with us about an experience with a Surgeon General advising over policy that matters?
Well, there's probably several. I mean, these were the Surgeons General. It's to date, it's been we've had 3 women and 15 men have served in the position of Surgeon General in the United States since the first Surgeon General. And I was fortunate enough for serving with directly for 6 Surgeons General, have continued to become certainly colleagues and friends with the Surgeons General who came after I left the service in the Public Health Service. But in the early days, when I first arrived as a young physician, not quite sure what all this federal public policy was about, I had these wonderful conversations with Julie Richmond. Julie was a child psychiatrist, and he had been dean and chair of pediatrics in several institutions in the country. And Julie started to talk about the challenges that kids were facing. And some of the stories, Julie was a wonderful teacher, and his focus was largely in his directives to me, as well as many of his other students, was it's critically important to know the knowledge base, to know the facts about a particular topic. But the facts don't speak for themselves. The second issue that Julie would talk about was summoning the political will, trying to get folks to see that there were challenges that needed solutions, and particularly for children. Children don't really have a voice, even though they all have parents, and we think we're advocates for them. Children per se get lost often in lots of the challenges that are faced. But I think the third and most important part that Julie would talk about was, once you knew the science and once you could build the political will, you really needed a clear social strategy to implement it. And to me, that social strategy meant the federal government was, the federal level is enabling, but the real action is at the family and at the community level.
Well, you know, go ahead.
Go ahead, Anna. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, this background of having this social foundation, and I want to talk specifically about the women Surgeon Generals in just a second, but if we just skip one and go right into C. Everett Koop, tell us how C. Everett Koop, who was appointed by a Republican administration, perhaps expecting a different political agenda, maybe not, really, really took hold of that social platform that you say Julius Richmond really said was necessary.
Well, you know, Adam, you know, this is an important point in my policy education, if you will, at the 35,000 foot level. When President Carter lost the election and President Reagan won, I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen. And this was my first experience with a transition, if you will, at the federal level. President Reagan appointed Dr. C. Everett Koop, a pediatric surgeon from Philadelphia, as the nominee for to be Surgeon General. Interestingly enough, Dr. Koop's confirmation took about 9 months. I mean, he was not well received in the public health circles and on Capitol Hill when he first arrived. Interestingly enough, what that did for me, that enabled me to spend an enormous amount of time with Dr. Koop, and we would joke about why I hadn't chosen pediatric surgery as a discipline, and, and actually why, having been from Philadelphia, I escaped his skills and talents as a pediatric surgeon. So we got to become, fortunately, wonderful friends, and I began to see Dr. Koop as an individual who was incredibly committed to the well-being and welfare of children. I mean, he was a giant in pediatric surgery. He invented newborn intensive care for pediatric surgical patients.
But his work took a leap forward. I think in most people's minds, when they really understand that the work of the Surgeon General is to protect all Americans and against really the most preventable causes of disease, I don't know of a force that by moral persuasion made a greater impact on tobacco abuse and cessation and prevention in the 21st century. There may not have been anyone in the 20th century.
You know, in many ways, I mean, Chick would built on the legacy of the Surgeon General, but I think what Chick did was Chick
is Surgeon General Koop.
Yes, okay. Surgeon General Koop, yes. He acquired that name early on in his life, and it actually stood for Chicken Coop. And so Chick stayed with him, and his friends called him Chick. It was in the beginning, it was pretty intimidating to call Dr. C. Everett Koop, renowned pediatric surgeon and now nominee for Surgeon General, Chick. But he would peer over his glasses, and while stroking his beard, call me Chick, Woody. So it was. I couldn't imagine being in the operating room with him, but I certainly gave into that, and it was incredibly an amazing set of being a friend for 32 years after that initial meeting. But I think what Dr. Koop did, and I think frankly what all the Surgeons General have done, is they rely on the science. They don't yield to the political interpretations, if you will. It was Dr. Koop's science that led him to be an outspoken hero taking on big tobacco, talking about environmental tobacco smoke, side stream smoke. That's the issue of people who are actually not smoking themselves, but who are nearby a smoker, and identifying that even that, and that particularly affected children. Children were not necessarily primary smokers, certainly, thank God, but could and would inhale cigarette smoke, whether it was from their parents or whether it was in smoke-filled rooms or...
You're in the elevator.
Yeah, any place. So Chick really took that on and became an incredible outspoken person against Big Tobacco and the tobacco company.
And fast forwarding to the present day, what is the most important challenge that our nation's public health service is tackling?
Well, you know, the challenges we have today, and I'm certainly child-centric, but in that legacy of disease prevention and health promotion, there are probably several affecting children. Certainly, cigarette smoking continues to be a challenge, and while we've made incredible progress in the 50 years since the first Surgeon General's report in 1964, it's still a challenge. But I think today we've got some contemporary threats like obesity, mental health is an issue.
Certainly,
you know, I'm jumping over that some of the issues we've made some progress on. HIV is become more of a chronic disease now, but we still face cancer, heart disease. But I think chief among them in addition to overweight and obesity and promoting good health, is violence in our community. I mean, there's 9 children every day are become victims of gun violence in America. That's just sort of something that all of the surgeons general have found unacceptable.
Yeah, I know Dr. David Satcher, who you worked closely with, this was a particular priority of his.
Indeed. David also was a champion, I think, in moving the agenda forward around mental health and mental illness, and also overweight and obesity. But certainly David took on these issues as well. I mean, every one of the, you know, whether it was Julie who took on and established Healthy People, and Chick, who focused on, and frankly, all of them focused on tobacco, but Chick focuses on HIV and AIDS as a principal issue and focused on sex education for kids and how to prevent it when we didn't have an antibiotic or we didn't have a direct treatment. Certainly, Dr. Novello, Tony Novello, focused on kids with special needs. And Dr. Elders was an incredible voice for adolescent health, and David took up the challenge for mental health, and I think David pushed the envelope by forcing us to recognize the importance of not reducing disparities in health, but eliminating
disparities. It is exciting and encouraging to hear about the important work that so many Surgeon Generals have done and the important work you've done to advise them and to contribute to our nation's public health system. I don't know that everybody even knows that there is so much infrastructure and system and thinking about ways to advocate for children and other vulnerable populations. So thank you for sharing these stories with us and for the great work that you're doing.
Well, you're quite welcome. We could have gone on for quite a bit more.
I would love to.
Well, it's this personal bringing alive the people behind the mm-hmm. scenes who are maybe public, but I love the way that you're able to tell us through their first names, through personal stories, and we have to thank you, Dr. Kessel, for really bringing it alive and keeping it alive. And I know the work that you're continuing to do, because I know about it, really continuing to make an advocate for children's health and prevention. So thank you so much for being our guest today on Conversations.
Well, you're quite welcome.
We've been talking with Dr. Woody Kessel, former Assistant Surgeon General, about the United States Surgeon General, past, present, and future. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you, as a listener, have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first House Call question.
My 2-year-old was jumping on the couch with her 4-year-old cousin. I was in the other room and heard a thud coming from the living room. I saw my daughter on the floor, and when I picked her up, I noticed her eyes were rolled back in her head, and she appeared to be stunned and really out of it. It scared me, and when I checked her out at the clinic, the doctor said it was just a concussion. Does that sound right, and should I be doing anything differently?
Well, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it sounds like it was scary for you.
I mean, that's never a good sound when you hear it from another room. It's like, I'm a bad parent. I should have been in that room. I need to watch my
guilt.
Kids 100% of the time. Ain't going to work.
Right. And, you know, it's possible that, I mean, probably she fell and hit her head from jumping on the couch. There's a song about that, like, no more monkeys jumping on the bed. Or it's a story, a short story. You've read that?
Yeah, haven't,
Mama called the doctor, and the doctor said, no more monkeys jumping on the bed.
But the problem is that when you fall down, it could be because she hit her head and had a concussion, or mm-hmm. did something happen like a seizure that caused her to fall down on her head.
Yeah.
Even though that's less likely, I think you have to talk to your doctor and have things looked at here.
Yeah, get her checked out. And if it was a concussion, which is, you know, probably what happened, but and no one saw it, so it's hard to know, you would want to be careful that she didn't have another head injury. I mean, that age, kids hit their heads a lot, and you wouldn't want to have another head injury or a second concussion in the next several weeks. So I would watch pretty carefully for the next little bit.
Sounds good. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I was in a car accident 6 weeks ago. I didn't go to the hospital because I felt fine, but I was later told that I had whiplash. 6 weeks later, my neck is still sore, and I'm worried I made a huge mistake. Do I need to get x-rays?
Well, it was a huge mistake being in a car accident, but you know what? It probably wasn't your fault, and even if it was, these things happen, and unfortunately, car accidents are oftentimes kind of underestimated. One of my family members, Christy, just got hit from behind, and you know, they didn't black out, they didn't hit their head, but they had whiplash injury, which is this persistent neck pain.
Yeah, this just happened to someone near and dear to me as well. And you know, x-rays in that 6 weeks later are probably not going to be that helpful. If you had had some major damage to your bones in your neck, you probably would have known it before now. That being said, sometimes it brings peace of mind to have that done, especially tied to the actual event. And you'll probably find out you've got some mild arthritis or other things that they'll find that may or may not, probably are not related
to
the accident.
And then you're going to be worried about that. I think you can do those things. I also just think some very gentle massage, mm-hmm. some thermal therapy, i.e. ice.
Or heat.
But some gentle things would be.
Anti-inflammatories.
Yoga, stretching, mm-hmm. nothing real hard.
I agree with that. And we wish you all the best. It really is scary when it hurts for so long, but it does get better.
And hopefully talk with your family doctor. What's our very next house call, Erica?
During my last appointment, my doctor mentioned Victoza for my diabetes. How is this different from my regular insulin and Lantus?
Well, obviously the name of this drug, Christy, Victoza. I mean, there's victory here.
Victoza. It's well named.
But it has another name that we must tell you about.
Yes. So it's liraglutide is the fancy name, which is called, it's like a, the abbreviation for it is GLP-1, which is a glucagon-like peptide.
Oh, that really helps.
Doesn't that tell, explains
that
to everyone exactly what it is?
I think we'll just call it
Don't
Victoza
you know?
For now.
But it can reduce that hemoglobin A1C, which is that average number of how your blood sugar's been running. It can reduce it by about 1% to 1.5%, which can be significant for people.
Yeah. The drug does have a pretty, you know, side effect profile you got to read about. There, you know, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting that's there. And it is not cheap, $500 a month probably, but it may be appropriate. So talk with your doctor.
Especially
Erica.
If sometimes you take it with the insulin or sometimes you take it as a second line after you've been on metformin. So it is a good drug.
In the right person.
That's exactly
who has
right.
Good prescription coverage.
Okay.
Erica, our last house call.
I've had a deep pain in my side and developed a rash in a different place. I was worried it was shingles and wanted to treat it just in case with medication and a vaccine. My doctor didn't think it was shingles, but gave me the medication just in case. Since I'm only 40, she wouldn't give me that vaccine. Shouldn't I have been given it?
Nope.
No, I would disagree with that. Partly because the vaccine is not for treatment of shingles. And so I think it sounds like you wanted it thinking it might make your possible shingles better. And the vaccine would not. But also, it's really recommended by the CDC to be given after age 60 and approved if you're over age 50 in special circumstances. But certainly as young as you are and in the setting of this sort of maybe shingles, but probably not shingles.
But you will need it when you get to be
older,
over age 50, and certainly indicated right now by authorities when you're 60. So that'll conclude some really good house calls today. And Christy, that's the wrap for a show today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. And we hope we've answered important questions to your health.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Woody Kessel. And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.